What congregation was your father the president of?
The Knesset Israel, K-N-E-S-E-T-H, Israel, on Negley Avenue. It was a converted house, and my father, I should say, my brothers and I, paid for the entire building and renovation of all, and sometimes surreptitious there. It was called a cat shul. But he was very devout, and it became, maybe it was part hobby too. But he had been ill for many years and was devoting too much time to it.
Excuse me. Was your family interested in music or art in any way? I know you're an art collector now.
In no way at all. Their prime interest was struggle.
What about their political interests? Any?
Never heard them.
Nothing. I see.
Except that they were very happy to be an American. God bless America and all of that, because they had spent their lifetime in servility, more or less. As all Jews did.
Right. Can you tell us about your education? Your grade school, you did say you went to Fulton School.
I went to Fulton School. Then we became victims of a depression earlier than the official depression that began with the breaking of the stock market in October of 1929. We moved back to the hill at a house that my father owned, a very lovely house on Euclid Avenue.
Oh, so when went to Fulton, then it was Euclid Avenue where you
yes.
lived.
Yes. I see. And we moved back there temporarily. That temporary move was about 4 years.
And what street was that again? On
Manaca Place.
You moved from Euclid Avenue.
Right.
To Manaca
Place. And then, were you already then in high school at that
no,
time?
No, I was entering my last year in grade school.
So where'd you go
1927.
Then?
That was McKelvey School, where I had started. In fact, my parents were so busy raising children and working that I imagine at the age of 5 and a half, entering school yourself, walking there, introducing yourself. My teachers there for years told me about my first appearance.
Coming along.
Mm-hmm.
At McKelvey.
McKelvey. I'll backtrack. I went to Lecce School for a half a day, which was a block away. And even precociously, I have to say it, I may be very immodest in parts of this, I didn't like the school. The same day, transferred myself to McKelvey, two blocks up the road on Bedford Avenue, because legally I discovered at that age I really belonged to McKelvey and not at Lecce. I was in Midway Point, a block from each school.
So the very day that you started school, you changed
school. I was in two schools, quite right.
And high school was at Fifth Avenue.
Fifth Avenue High.
And then you did go on to college?
Yes.
University of Pittsburgh,
majored in journalism.
What was
Went in my senior year.
What was your family's opinion of that, journalism?
I could do no wrong.
I said, good. And you quit before
your senior year. I finished my major in journalism and my minor in history, and I was taking snap courses. This was in 1935, and I wasn't about to spend $10 a credit. Was it $10? It was $300 a year. That's right, $10 a credit. Waste my time taking astronomy and French and a few other things. I was very anxious to get into the commercial world. I've never stopped working.
So where did you, when you quit, what did you do? Was it in the middle of your senior year or at the beginning of the senior year?
Beginning.
So you didn't start your senior year?
Never started. Filled out all my cards. That was before the days of IBM. Took a half a day. You two were too young to remember this. You'd fill these 3x5 cards out of this sheet almost as big as this table. I was halfway through it. I said to myself, isn't this foolish? I have a $50 deposit. We're in the middle of the greatest depression this country ever had. I worked my way through school having a print shop in the back of my house. I said, I'm going to move that downtown and spend full time instead of a full course at Pitt. That was very active on the campus. I mean, as active as I was in academia. Very amusing when Pitt trustees came out here to this, my boardroom here, invite me 5 years ago to become a member of the Board of Trustees. I said, if I accept and you accept me, I'll be the only one in the history of your school who never finished college. They were astounded. They probably never had an undegreed person.
So while you were going to school, you had this print shop at your home?
Always. Actually, my father, for my 14th birthday, gave me a little Kelsey hand press. And I started being commercial from that day on.
And what did you print?
Business cards, name cards, bill heads, letterheads, envelopes. After school, I'd solicit the orders. I'd go back and set type and print it, deliver it, collect the money. I even had Agnes, who was going to Peabody. At one point, I had an idea. Most, you may remember, in high school, everyone had a name card with your name engraved or printed on it. And I got a representative in every high school in Pittsburgh. And I met Agnes Roman. I asked her if she wouldn't. She was a senior in her school at that time. No, wait a moment. No, she's a couple years younger, several years younger. Whatever she was in Peabody High. And she solicited orders for me.
And her last name was?
Roman, R-O-M-A-N.
Can you also tell us now anything about your health when you were a child, or the health care you received, or did anybody have any serious illnesses?
I think we all, fending for ourselves, we had a family of eight, mind you, with our parents. No time for regular checkups or any of the things that our kids have today. And we had the usual signs that seemed to be on all the houses: diphtheria, measles, whooping cough.
Do you remember what you had?
I think I had the measles. I really don't recall.
Do you remember Dr. Barenfield?
No. Familiar name.
That's my father, because Jeanette remembers him.
Dr. Barenfield.
Did he take care of that family?
Jeanette.
Did? Well, then she would know.
She
you and Jeanette about the same age?
Yes, I think. Mm-hmm. She remembered him.
The name is familiar to me. Where was his office?
Well, probably at that time on Center Avenue.
That's where the doctors were, near Aaron Street.
But do you remember, you don't remember the health care then as a child? Just remember everybody was sick and got well.
Every kid got a disease, and you were joyously at home.
When you were an adolescent, what did you do for fun? Recreation.
Let's pick out ages.
Oh, let's say 14.
Well, at 14, athletically, I was interested in gymnastics, which happily became very popular today, and I was our city champ in high school. And I was always interested in spectator sports, of course. I would say my only athletic prowess was gymnastics, but it was 365 days a year for me. Because during vacation or on the beach or anything, I would practice every day.
And how did you arrive at that interest in those days? In school, from school?
In school.
Uh-huh. Anything with music or art that you are interested in now?
Well, my parents forced me to have Dr. Hershenson's father, we called him Professor Hershenson, teach me to play the violin.
And you didn't take to that too well?
How long did you play it?
Oh, I think he came around for a couple of years.
And who was it, Dr. Who, Hershenson?
It's Dr. Morris, the late Dr. Morris Hershenson's father. Remember, with a big black sombrero hat. And we forced our son Marshall to do it, too. And his teacher is now world-renowned, Lauren Mazel.
Yeah.
Lauren used to come to our house on Inverness. And Pete's Marshall as his father Lincoln did prior to that. But I think like father and son, Marshall gave it up too. Today he's very interested in music. He's a member of the board of directors of the Pittsburgh Opera and other things like that.
Tell us about your courtship, marriage, children, that part
of your life. Yes, I dated Agnes, and Agnes Roman. She had always lived in the East End part of Pittsburgh. She lived on Rural Street. And at that time, I think I lived on St. Clair Street, in the hill we're back to.
I see.
East End for many, many years.
When did you meet her?
Well, I think she was going with a friend of mine at a party, and I must have called her thereafter, I don't recall, and we dated for a long time.
What year were you married?
1937, August 12th.
And your children, of course, Marshall?
Marshall was born in 1939, and Andrea in 1942.
All right, can you tell us about...
Where were you living then? When you first married?
When we were first married, 414 South Graham Street. You know, I remember Dr. Barenfeld now. Talk to Jeanette as to how old we were.
Right. Dark hair with a mustache. I think he always has a mustache. Always.
We must have been very small children then. Your father practiced 50 years ago in the morning.
Oh, sure.
You lived on South Graham Street when you and Aggie were first married.
Correct.
And then when Marshall was born, where did you live?
King Avenue. That's up by Highland Park.
Tell us about Marshall and a little bit about his life.
Sure. Marshall, as I say, was born in 1939, he was born on September 17th, just about a few weeks after the war started. And he was raised differently than we were. The struggle wasn't there, and there were less children to get involved in. I suppose if instead of having six children, my parents had two, things would have been different, but I would never want them changed. Poor Jeanette, the only girl out of six, we murdered her.
She's so sweet, well. Bob. Yes, she's very sweet. And Marshall is married to...
Marshall is married to a very lovely girl, Wallace Fisk, from New York City.
And they have children?
One child, Lauren Sarah.
Lauren Sarah?
Yes.
And at this point, how old is
it? Nine.
And your daughter? She's married?
Andrea is married to R. Jeffrey Plessett. They were childhood sweethearts. Charlie Plessett's son. We lived at... on Inverness, they lived around the corner in Fair Oaks. And they were married about 10 years ago. They have two children, my beautiful granddaughter, Nicole, who is eight. No, will be eight, sorry, is seven. And that wild man, Jonathan, who will be five.
Where do they live?
They live on Linden Avenue.
Then from King Avenue, you moved to Inverness? From King?
No, from King we moved to Euclid. By a quirk of coincidence, about three or four doors away from where I lived as a child.
Wow.
And then Inverness?
No, then we moved to a house on corner of Stanton and Beatty. And in 1944, to Inverness, where we remained for 23 years. So Selma, where did you live before your palatial home presently?
On Albemarle. For 27 years.
Mm-hmm. And from Inverness to Gateway.
How long? 22 years
well,
on Inverness?
Well, a little different.
What did you say, 22 years?
23 years.
23 years.
In 1960, we bought Paul Getty's apartment in New York. And we were spending so much time there that actually even today our social life is divided into two complete sets of social lives, New York City and Pittsburgh. Maybe more so there because we spend a great deal of time there. Should say there's more leisure time there than here.
But it's mainly social, not business, or business is connected?
It's business for me, it isn't the 9 to 5 or 9 to 7 or whatever it is. A little different there. And we have a large apartment able to home, with the result that we thought that would become our principal home, and we'd have a pied-à-terre here, which is our present apartment, which unfortunately we're buying this week.
Yeah.
They turned us into a condo. I just talked to their sales manager. We'll probably buy it and sell it at a loss a year from now. We're going to look around for one of the new ones that are being built. However, this building you're in now, which is the largest plant in the city of Pittsburgh, 1 million square feet, was under construction about the time we were thinking of making New York home number one and Pittsburgh number two. Mm-hmm. Well, it never turned out that way. So we live in both cities, but for tax purposes, as your husband well understands, I prefer to be a Pennsylvanian.
Right. I guess then you've always been in the journalism, printing, and that sort of business. How did
creative
you,
business.
Right. Now, let's get to this business.
Well, this one's been widely written up, so I could almost read if I went to something. Well, let's see. You want my business career?
Yes.
I would say that it started... I was always entrepreneurial. As a youngster, like a lot of other kids who sold things house to house, I was the leading Saturday Evening Postman in my area. I remember once running into the publisher of the Saturday Evening Post and told him I was glad they made them skinny now for kids. When I was there, and it was a nickel a copy, it was 3/8 of an inch thick. But I used to sell so many of them. Got to a point that I graduated selling subscriptions. I was 10 years old then. On weekends, I had always earned about $100 a week doing all kinds of things. I had made money since I was a kid. I never stopped. And at any rate, actually, all my businesses were a progression from one to another, and none of them could be called conglomerating, because they were somewhat related to one another. Because I've always had a bent both in art and journalism. And even when I went to Pitt, I tried to enroll in Carnegie Tech, that name you remember, and Pitt. Major in art there and journalism here, because my forte was an interest in art. Actually, I was an artist as well. In fact, the Pitt Panthers for 2 years had my covers. And and a writer. However, that wasn't permissible then. I tried to get the school to put it through. I even had my journalism prof try on my behalf. At any rate, there was a progression of my businesses, so my present enterprise really has its roots way back there. First, my little hand printing press. Then when I left school in my senior year, I moved the printing press and added more. It was down, I tell Lottie Falk that the building she's in now, 244 Boulevard of Allies, I had the 8th floor, 800 square feet. Agnes became my secretary then. She tells everyone that I had to force her to hold depositing of the weekly check. I think it was about $9 or $10 or $12. That is 1936. And I was always restless and never stopped. And I realized I don't like to get that much ink in my fingernails. And I admired the people who came around and sold me paper. I always wore a necktie. I said that one day, I'm going to the paper business. My family said, where are you going to get the money? I said, don't worry about it, I'm going into it. And I started in the wholesale paper business, selling printer's paper, and that was called Printer's Paper Supply Company in 1937.
Printer's
Paper Supply Company.
You started that?
Yes, because I didn't have the capital to get franchise lines like Hammermill Pond or Crane's Crest.
So what were you selling? You started the Printer's Paper Supply Company and sold what?
Fine paper is the classification it's called, the printers. And what I did, I went around to paper mills all through the United States. And I said, I want to buy anything you can't sell. But I need long-term credit. I have no money. And there's one man that I befriended later. On 1937, one of my trips took me to the big paper-making sector in Ohio called the Miami Valley, between Dayton and Cincinnati. Big paper mills like Chappie were there. And I went to one in Franklin called Miami Valley Coated Paper Company. I walked in and audaciously asked for the president. And this fellow came out. We became very staunch friends in the oncoming years. A fellow named Albert Sreri.
How do you spell that?
S-R-E-R-E.
S-R-E-R-E.
I told him what I wanted. He said, well, we've got a lot of that around here. Why don't you and Sig Oppenheimer, who is a refugee from Germany, who is an assistant, he accompanied me. I went all through the mill, and I selected what Sig said was four carloads. Mr. Sreri said, now, how are you going to pay for it? Are you giving me a check in advance? He said, I have no money. I said, you're going to have to give me credit on how you think I look and act, and I don't think I'm worth $500. And he said, well, can you pay me in a couple of weeks? I said, no, it'll take me 3 months to sell it. I'll give you a note, and I'll put all the interest on that you want, and I'll pay you the day it's due. I paid him about 3 days before. Mm-hmm. But I bought paper for 3 and 4 cents a pound, and ingeniously, I say that today, found new uses for it. For example, I bought some purple covered paper, a carload of it. You couldn't sell that in 15 years. I decided that would be great for restaurants, for menus, found new uses for paper that the mill didn't think they'd normally sell.
So the type of paper you selected was writing paper, or what was it?
Writing paper, cover paper, book paper, letterhead paper, things like that. And I paid Sreri before it was due, and then became his biggest customer. Now, he told me, he never got married until he was about 50, because he owned 29 paper mills, and the 29 is a number I remember, because he was on a train 29 nights of the month, had no time to meet women. He owned so many mills all through the country. He was a tycoon in the field, that he went bankrupt as a result of the bubble that broke. He had a contract with Collier's Magazine and a contract with Scandinavian pulp makers. He kept up his end of the contract, but when the bottom fell out of the newsprint market, Collier's found a legal way of getting out of theirs, and he couldn't meet his obligation. He lost all his mills but one, the one I visited, because his good friends in Dayton, where he was a leading citizen, had participated in ownership. And he was in receivership. He told me years later that after he sold me that first lot of paper, carloads of it, he was almost fired by the receiver, the Franklin National Bank in his town, for giving me credit. They drew a D&B and they saw I had no assets, zero. But years later, he came to see me, and he said, Joe, I want to get out of the receivership. I need help. I said, how much money do you need? He told me, like, called my secretary in to bring my personal checkbook in, wrote a check out for it. He said, well, how much interest do you want? I said, Al, nothing. I owe you. He cried like a child. Poor guy died. I attended his funeral about 5 or 6 years later. He was in such rags, I have to tell you, I just happened to think of this. I remember I helped him on. To me, he was an older man. He was probably in his early 50s then. I was a kid in my early 20s. And I remember helping him out with his coat one day on one of my trips, and the lining in shreds. Married a marvelous lady who was one of the Jewish social leaders of that part of the Hyatt.
He was Jewish?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Odd name, S-R-E-R-E.
Yes, right.
Almost sounds like he could have come from the Middle East. His family could have.
So you started off on credit, and then how gradually did you build up?
It got to a point I became restless again. Why should I be a middleman? Because I have a creative bent. I want to do things. Why should I sell paper to people who want to do things? And I didn't want to compete with that printers, because I'd be back where I was. I'd be competing with my customers, which would be unfair, and aside from the morality of it, I'd lose it. World War II came along. I was having lunch with someone at Kaufman's one day, and I said, "What's new in the story?" He said, "Well, we have a victory center on the second floor. We do an awful lot of military paper with all the kids in the army now, people were writing." And I said, "Let's take a look at it." So after lunch, we walked down there, and I took a look around at boxes of Crayons and Montag's writing paper. And then also portfolios, the leather embossed. And I said to the young lady behind the counter, "Now, do you sell many of these portfolios?" She said, "Well, for every few boxes, we sell one." Then I said, "They have to buy two things, and the soldier in his close-in quarters doesn't have space." And right then and there, I got an idea, and I said, "Now, how would you like to get a box of stationery with the top built like a desk with a blotter and leatherette corners?" I said, "Oh, that would be good." So I told my friend who worked in Kaufman's, I said, "Take me to whoever is a merchandise manager here." And he took me to Maurice Sanger. Do you remember him years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And Sanger said to me, "Well, Katz, what do you think this would sell for?" And I trying to figure out the cost. I had no idea what department store markups were. I said, "Well, how much do you need?" He said, 40%. I said, "Well, it could sell for 98 cents. He said, "How about making it double that and giving us more merchandise and everything?" I said, "Fine, give me an order. Give me an order for a gross. We won't make anything on it. We'll make it." And he did.
And what did you sell it for?
It sold for $1.98. It sold to him for $1.17. That's 40 off. That was the beginning of really a whirlwind new business career, because for the first time, instead of being local and regional, I used to call on printers to sell them paper in the Tri-State District, say down to Bolero, Hyatt, mm-hmm. Wheeling, and so forth. Now it was national. For the first time, I was visiting department stores throughout the nation, and I sold every one of them. There was no one I didn't sell.
What was it under the name of Anything Special?
Yes, Joseph M. Katz and Company.
And these packets or boxes were called what?
That was called the Right Kit. Became
how one do you spell it?
R-I-T-E hyphen K-I-T, capitalized, of course. And I patented it. And it became one of the best known items for servicemen throughout the world. I ran into people for decades who remembered owning it, or they were writing on the ship.
So it was a box of writing paper with a
leatherette with the top was a blotter, and it was made of a very heavy duty cardboard, covered, of course. Mm-hmm. You could almost stand on it. And I had my brother Harry, who's a good looking guy in uniform, one day when he was back on furlough, pose. Had him downtown a photographer, and it showed him lying in a bunk, writing on it, another one writing on his knee. And that, it was tremendous. I think I made $1 million or $2 million out of it.
May I ask you a question? You talk about going from your printing to selling paper to this. Did you discontinue the printing when you went ahead, or did you continue doing it?
Quit.
Did you stop selling paper when you went into this? All right.
Not to compete.
So it wasn't an enlargement then. It was continuing
right.
in a new business.
But it was really a continuation in the form of the former
right.
business. I became, as I said, Surrey's biggest account, because one day when I was down there, I was watching a machine making a paper. Prior to calendaring it, the paper is coated and it's got a rough finish. Then it gets calendared with a highly polished finish. And it looked like it would make a great writing paper. This was a book paper. So I tore some sheets off the machine, took it into his office, and wrote on it, and it feathered, you know, the word spread. I said, gee, what a great paper, but the darn trouble is you can't write on it. He said, we can have it retreated. And he did. I created something called Suede Tone Pastel. We could have used two paper mills outputs on it.
And what was that Suede Tone Pastel?
A paper? Was social writing paper.
That's after your... But that's in addition to your...
In addition to, or I expanded Wright Kit to go in the social end, so that when the war ended,
right,
we continue, because Wright Kit had printed on the letterheads the insignia of the Army, like Air Force and Navy and so forth, Coast Guard. And then, of course, it's very easy to sell. You didn't have to be a master salesman. There's a big shortage.
Is Wright Kit still sold at all to the military?
No. That ended.
And then after the war, you went into social writing paper then?
No, that was during that period.
Oh, I see. So then
when
after
Wright
the war...
Kit made so much money, I expanded it.
So Wright Kit discontinued after war.
Right. As I discontinued the entire stationery business. It had gone down to 1 year, I only made $116,000 profit. I said, that's too small for me. But during the war period, when I was really coining money, but frankly, I wish I knew her husband then, because he'd have incorporated me. I paid, like, personally, like $400,000 or $500,000 in tax 1 year. And I'd been incorporated properly, it would have been less. At any rate, I wasn't a pauper. But...